Hello and welcome to Untangled Resolution's presentation of Sangoma, Stories from the Frontlines of Mediation. I am Batabile Mtombini, your host, and I'm a mediator and conflict coach, and I'm very excited to welcome to the show today Evelyn Lindner. Have I pronounced that correctly?
Yes.
who I met a few years ago and didn't get to spend a lot of time with, but I was very fascinated by her story and about the work that she does, and I'm delighted to have an opportunity to have her come and chat with us and share that with us. I do want to say one thing before we begin. If you wish to call in and you're listening to this live and you wish to call in and ask Evelyn some questions, the phone number to call is 646-595-2229. That's 646-595-2229. You have the option of calling in just to listen, and then you can also call in to be on the show and to ask questions. Welcome, welcome. How are you doing?
Thank you so much. It's me who is to be with you. Very, very honored. Very mutual.
Yes. So you're here. First, let's begin with why you're here in the United States at this time. You're not always here.
That's right. I'm in Manhattan in November, December each year for the workshop on transform. Mediation and violence at Columbia University. Here it's the 6th of December, and whoever is interested, you know, write to me and us and look at the website at mediationstudies.org. There you find all the information and register for this. It's our time that we have that each year in December. And Moritz, who is the father of conflict resolution, he is our honorary convener. Since 2003, it was he who really did a small conference, and from then on we picked up and we did it every year.
10 years.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yes.
I didn't realize that it had been 10 years. I mean, that 10 years had passed. I think the time has passed so quickly.
Right. Yes, I met Mort in 2001.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But and then of course, if folks want to go to the conference, as you said, it is the website again.
Humiliation Studies in one word, and then .org. Then you find who we are, and you click on who we are on the left side, and you see all kinds of. You see my biography there, everything.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, then speaking of your biography, I am fascinated by the story that you tell, and I'm sure that folks who are listening are going to find it fascinating as well. I remember the first time I saw you speak, it was at one of these workshops, and I remember being floored by your story. It is amazing, poignant, heartbreaking, and yet you are using it for the benefit of humankind. So please tell us your story.
You know, I'm preparing now for sharing this story at this workshop, and each year I have changed and I need to tell it in a new way. And this year is particularly difficult. I just spent 3 months in South Africa, opening up more to what is the name of your radio. It is Sangoma. And somehow opening much more up to that sphere of life, which has changed me and moved me. And, you know, whenever I'm changed, I need to somehow redefine what I think. And so I'm in this process now. And, you know, before you came, I was thinking about how did I come to the topic and theme of humiliation, dignity, and humiliation as its violation. And I think it really comes from, I always say it comes because I'm born into a displaced family full of trauma, and that trauma was really humiliation at many, many, many levels. Like my parents, you know, I grew up in a family with an identity of here where we are. We are not at home, and there is no home to go to for us. There is no place for us on this planet. We are not part of the human family.
Well, what does that mean? How did that happen?
It is simply the history of Europe. You had about 10 to 15 million people forcibly displaced in 1945-46. Imagine you live in a house and you get the notice that tomorrow at 10 you have to gather in the street. You can take a small suitcase, but if you change, destroy anything in your house, you are shot. You have to keep the house like it is, and you have to keep the key of the door outside so other people can come in, and you will never come back, and you will not know where to transport you. So you are next to you with your little suitcase, and then you put it on the plane, and you will not know where it goes. Parents could have been Siberia, many, and Siberia. I could have a Russian passport now. My father wanted to go to Canada. I would be a Canadian passport. By chance, they ended up in Central Europe. It later became West Germany, East Germany. Completely by chance. But still, 60 years or 70 years after this happened, my parents would every day say, if we only could go home. And home is the place where they come from, which is called Silesia. It's an area in Central Europe that does not exist anymore. It has changed nationality. You know, like the city where my mother was born has, you know, about 98%, I think, of the population was taken out and other people moved in, who were also displaced. So it wouldn't be making any sense, like in the Middle East, where people say we have a right to return. Thank you very much. I don't want to return there because it would mean another war in Europe. It would mean displacing people again. So, you know, this has happened in Europe often, more than here. Here it has happened in America. It has happened, but not that frequent, I think. So, yes, and so this is where I come from. Until the age of 45, I really had a deep feeling of I have no right to be on this planet. I have no right to breathe, to use the air or eat or use any resources or to be here. I'm not a legitimate human being. So this is my startup identity, and people, you know, I have white skin and blonde hair, and people think, oh, a privileged European or, you know, white person. You know, be careful with these prejudices, you know.
And, you know, they're very, very, very strong.
Yes.
Very strong.
Yes.
Because I remember myself having this just tremendous visceral, I mean, I cried the first time I heard you speak. Yeah, you know, I came to the workshop and you start speaking about humiliation and dignity and a need for us to all recognize each other. And I don't remember exactly what it is that you said, but I found it profoundly disturbing and difficult to hear because of who it was coming from.
Right.
And it's been a marvelous opportunity for me to broaden my perspective of, you know, what it means to be a displaced person and making assumptions that that is something that is unique to people of color, perhaps.
Yes.
You know, and Jewish people.
Yes.
You know, those are the common stories that we hear about who gets displaced and so forth.
Yes.
And so to hear you, you know, with your particular accent and with the way that you look, you know, saying these things, there was that sort of, you know, well, who are you to be saying this to me? You who represents to me the oppressor, the colonizer, you know, the reason that I didn't grow up in my home with my family. And I don't know, you know, my cousins and my aunts and grandparents and so forth very well, didn't get to grow up in that kind of family. And so now, you know, fully hearing your story and understanding that we share so much in common. For the longest time, my identity was undetermined resident alien.
Right.
Isn't that great?
Yes.
Isn't that awesome? It's
Yes,
amazing.
so you are a resident of Mars, perhaps,
It
or
was
of another galaxy.
fabulous.
Stuff like that.
It was fabulous. What happened is that my family, when I was born, South Africa, because I'm from South Africa had not yet decided what reservation to put us on.
Okay.
So they were getting ready to do this big thing where
right.
they would do the same thing that happened to your family.
Right.
Mass displacements. And mass
right.
displacements had happened.
Yes.
People know about Sophia Town, about District 6 and so forth. Well, they were, going to do this. And when I was born, they hadn't decided yet.
Right.
So under citizenship in my birth, on my birth certificate,
right.
it says undetermined.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then when I came to the United States, we got green cards, and the green card says you're a resident alien.
Right.
So my identity until we took American citizenship, well, actually, until Nelson Mandela was elected, and
okay.
we got to participate in the election and so forth, I refused to take American citizenship until
oh.
apartheid ended in South Africa. And so until that point, our status was unidentified or undetermined resident alien.
Right.
So when you tell this story about displacement, we're not comparing here. It's not a competition of
no.
displacement.
Of course.
But, I try to imagine what it might be to be from a place that no longer exists.
Mm.
Because at least I still do have that. We
right.
now have a home.
Right.
We can go back to South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
There are reparations
yeah.
In process and so forth. But then, now I sit back and I think about that visceral reaction that I had and the assumptions that came out of that and the ways that we attach certain meaning to phenotype.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm sure that in your work, this is something that you are exploring as well, and I don't want to take us too far off track
yep.
in terms of your story,
yep.
but I did want to highlight that, it is an amazing opportunity
Absolutely.
For us to examine certain kinds of assumptions that are made about who is privileged.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. So what does happen then as you're telling your story and then dealing with what might be at least in the beginning sort of a barrier to you being the bearer, the messenger of this while at the same time inhabiting this white skin with blonde hair and blue eyes and,
right.
and so forth?
Right. As I said, I spent 3 months in South Africa just now, and I spent 6 weeks with Catherine Odora Hoppers. She holds a very special chair, professor chair in Pretoria. She is mandated with reforming the university system there. And we went very deeply into our backgrounds. We want to make a documentary on her life. She grew up in Uganda and went into exile twice. And she has a very lovely, she's also an artist, painting where you see the mouth of a crocodile open, and on the tongue is a white and a black person fighting their fight of resisting colonization. And so her message is, okay, all these fights are somehow fights that are embedded into a bigger problem, namely the mouth of the crocodile, and even the winners will be eaten. we all will be eaten.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bigger problem out there in the world than, for example, resisting colonization of the past. There's a new kind of colonization going on, and I know that so deeply because, when my parents were displaced and I was born, I was then born in the little village where my parents were forced to be, or, the village was forced to take some of these people who had nothing, nobody wanted them, so they were kind of forced there. And it was a farm, a traditional farm with all animals and many people working together. It was the traditional farm that my friend Catherine Odora Hoppers in Uganda also had. It's a homestead. Okay, a little bit different, but this community life, the communal sharing, the force of the collective, all that I experienced for the first 6 years of my life in Germany. Okay, and then I observed the same destruction, the same colonization of communities, of the cohesion that is in collectives, I observe the same destruction there that she observes in Uganda. We observe it everywhere. This is the mouth of the crocodile where we all are in. And I, you know, she doesn't need to, you know, it's, she speaks about Uganda. I just repeat the same thing about my past. It's that, you know, that we at the moment worldwide, globally, are creating a world. We all know that, that is not sustainable both ecologically and socially. And this is the big problem. And there we are united. You know, I have experienced the same destruction as she has in Africa. It's a colonization of our minds, of our lives. It's a squeezing of all the resources of our planet and our human resources. Squeezing and squeezing and squeezing. And this is hurting me, and I'm colonized by that as much as anybody.
Well, then, in addressing this, you know, I'm thinking of a way to get into how it is that you have come to address this. Let's back up a little bit. You say that you grew up on this farm until you were six. Mm-hmm. You are witnessing all of this displacement.
Yes, I was born into a displaced family.
Right.
I was not suffering so much.
Yeah.
I could have been mistreated by the local people, but I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So I somehow understood the suffering of my parents only slowly, because mm-hmm. I was embedded in this farm. I didn't know that it was one of the happiest times of my life. I learned that later. Then my parents fulfilled their dream to have their little apartment, you know, the little nuclear family together. This was the end of my life. This was at the age of six. Then I saw, you know, I experienced how this colonization, which we can call it now, you know, this destruction of the social glue, social cohesion of the collective, how it works. It works systemically. It's not something we are doing with ill intentions. It's, you know, like my parents, my mother especially, fulfilled a dream, you know, to be her own boss in her own little apartment. But for me, it was the end of being together, you know, the end of togetherness.
Well, because you leave this collective that
yes.
you have been
yes,
born into.
I'm now with only one person, my mother.
Mm.
What an impoverishment.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, and, you know, if this mother then is a mature person, you're lucky. But what if she is not?
Mm-hmm.
Then you are delivered, you know, you have no network around, no security around you. You know, so I went to school where there was a quasi, we know all how schools are made. Kind of, then you have to sit still, and then you have to learn that, and then you have to learn that. While in the first 6 years, I knew everything. I learned it just like that. I knew exactly how chicken meat must be fed, how bees are. I knew everything about everything. And I learned it just by living there and being part of it. And I, you know, I looked down on this kind of impoverished system that was called school, and this impoverishment of living with a nuclear family in a little apartment. For me, this was a huge impoverishment, and only later I understood that it's systemic, how it's systemic, how it informs us in our dreams, you know. So today I joke about that, you know, when I live globally, as you alluded to in the beginning, which means I have no house. I built a global community that is similar to these first 6 years, a global family. This is what I invest my life in, and I live in the homes of these families. And people say, oh, next year you are going to be in India. I said, yes. Oh, you will need a place to stay. I say, I never need a place to stay. This is not what I want. A place to stay means you have four walls and a roof. And I jokingly say, you know, if you really only want a place to stay, you better commit some kind of minor offense so that you end up in prison. There you have a place to stay and you are a friend. You don't have to pay. That's the best thing if you want a place to stay. I don't want a place to stay. I want to be welcomed with love. I want loving context. So I wait. I ask, who wants me? And then I only need a mattress and internet, because I'm the webmaster of our website. But, you know, I was in the Amazon rainforest in the slum, 30,000 people in the slum around me, and the roof had was leaking and one needed to cover the computer with plastic. No problem. One doesn't even need a roof necessarily, you know, but one needs a loving context.
Okay, so talk to me about how you made this, what was the process that you went through to finally reach a place where you're living a life that I can only think of at the moment as rather conventional. I'm sure when people, I remember when I first heard you describe this life, I thought to myself, wow, you know, I don't know whether I could feel secure in that way, you know, not having a house, not having a place that I call home, an address that, you know, is mine, it's my permanent address. You know, on forms, when you fill them out, they say, you know, what is your permanent address? And so I'm curious about how you find, you know, stability and you know, a place where you are located when you don't have a home in the conventional sense.
Right. You know, what my family's fate taught me was that clinging to something is not necessarily a good idea. It can disappear very quickly. So, in short, I usually say, what is safety? What gives safety? To cling to illusionary fixities or to learn to swim in the flux of life? What really gives the feeling of security and safety is to learn to swim in the flux of life. Of course, it's not so easy, you know. The first reaction of everybody is to cling. It's not easy to learn to swim. It needs some effort. So I invite everybody to do that, to make that effort, because it's so much richer. Life after that is so much richer. And it's not the illusion of fixity. You know, to live with the illusion of fixity is a hollowing one's soul. You know, and what I do is connecting, always connecting with people, with everything, with our planet, always connecting, and that it fills me also with nourishment for my soul that is very deep. So I avoid the fear of uncertainty, and I receive so much many riches. You know, so it's a win-win situation. Learn to swim.
You said you avoid the fear of uncertainty when, at the same time, you know, I mean, I've just said that for me it would seem to be a really uncertain way of living.
Exactly.
It's kind of ironic, though, that I'm saying that, because I should be honest with you, and later when we're done with this conversation, I'll show you the little video I made about the RV, recreation vehicle, that I've purchased. I bought a camper, and my plan is to renovate it and to live in it.
Yes.
So I'm actually asking some of these questions out of a great deal of self-interest, because I'm really thinking, you know, how do you do it? Because honestly speaking, I'm about to embark on something that's really similar myself. So I'm asking these questions not to say, are you nuts? But
right.
I think I'm nuts too. So like, how do you do it? Right.
Right.
So, you know, you said you avoid uncertainty. Then, you know, it's going to be, it's November, it's December.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know where you'll be in January?
Yes, I will be in Oslo. I've planned about two years ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So I will be in Oslo. Last year I spent normally January, February there, because I love the winter, the deep snow. Last time I moved six times, that's six homes. This year I will have three homes. So then I will be in Thailand from March onwards. We'll have our next conference then in, we have two conferences per year, one in the here in New York in December, and the other one always outside of the United States, and the next one will be in Thailand. And so I will be there for 6 weeks, and. So it's, you know, so it's November, December, Manhattan, January, February, Oslo, and the rest is global. And every year, different, like this year, South Africa, last year, Latin America, South America. So I think, and this is what I really have learned more in South Africa, how much I live the life that we as human beings, modern human beings, have lived for the first 95% of our history. And what an aberration the past 12,000 years since the Neolithic revolution. Difficult time this was in our history, and how it has handicapped us. And somehow, if we look at, for example, systematic war, it started after the Neolithic revolution. You know, when you plant something in spring and you want to harvest in autumn, your neighbors might steal it. You have to guard, and then you know the systematic war came up then, you know, better weapons were developed and. And, you know, we see today veterans commit suicide. Why? Because we humans are not made for killing. This is not our nature. We are not made for this culture that characterizes our history after the Neolithic revolution that started in many places like 12,000 years ago, but in other places later. So we are not made for that. Our nature is not like that. We are nuts. We are made nuts, you could say, in that period. Like, for example, training young men to think it's honorable to die in war to kill others. How come? Isn't that nuts? Okay, so then, right. We know. But of course, we have to understand how we got there, you know. And so this is part of what I try to understand. And I see how healing it is to live more in the way our ancestors lived, who lived before the Neolithic Revolution, who were more migratory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would even, people say, oh, you are a nomad. I'm not a nomad because I live in the global village. And if you live there, you don't travel, you are not a nomad, you live there. So I have eradicated words like travel, I'm never a guest, I don't visit, I'm always at home. So I'm at home on this planet as our ancestors were, more than we think, you know, that we lived in a little piece of land and guarded against our enemies. This is not our history, not our legacy. Connection is our legacy. And I understand that from my own life, much, much deeper than simply theoretically by studying archaeology and anthropology. So, and by then also understanding our prehistory as human beings in Africa and the cradle of humankind. And so, yeah, so I think what I do is a healing lifestyle. It's also very liberating. I don't have to buy things. I don't accumulate things, you know. And if we look at our planet, we are now using 1.5 planets. Mm-hmm. It's unsustainable. Yeah. Soon we will need 2, 3, 5, 6 planets. And it doesn't work. We know that. So we can't continue making products. We can't continue. And there we come against the questions that I then get. People say, oh, but how do you make a living? And don't you need a job? And don't you need an income? And so this connection between that you need to produce services or goods in order to be able to eat, to have a livelihood, this kills our planet. You know, we are producing, how full are our shops with gadgets nobody needs? We are burning the resources of our planet and we send them through the pipe so that people can have jobs. Is that not nuts either?
Yes.
So we have to deeply rethink, and somehow my life shows me how liberating it is if I don't have to accumulate things. I just don't, you know. So how free am I, you know? So I detect by living like that, I detect how healing and liberating this, you know, alternative, not alternative, it's basically the default life of human beings is, and how we have been brainwashed, you know. Also me, in the first years of my global life, I did believe people who said, you know, you will get sick, you have to settle down, you know, you have to have your things somewhere, you have to have a place you call home where you go back, and I believed that, you know. it took many, many, many years of experimenting, of, you know, then slowly standing by and thinking, perhaps I'm not crazy. Let's see, you know, does it really make me crazy? You know, and so, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh. I can't tell you just how tickled I am to be hearing this, because it, in many ways, and it's a little selfish, you've done a lot of hard work for me, because this is exactly what I would like to explore.
Mm.
I have come to many of the realizations that you have,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, it's marvelous how nuanced and multi-leveled it is, because it's not then just about, oh, you know, we consume too much, we produce too much, we are depleting our resources. You have found a way to connect that to the idea of humiliation and dignity.
Right.
And I think that you have distilled it to its essence in the sense that you're actually living it.
Absolutely.
Mm. You know, so it's not an idea.
No.
It's an idea. We talk about it, you write books about it, you know, but then you also live it.
Yes. I must say, you know, people say, but you are privileged. Yes. You know, I have a passport. There are about 30 passports, or 10% of the passports of this planet make it possible to live like I live. Normally, people are imprisoned in their countries by visa regulations. So I am privileged. And then I, by chance, ended in West Germany, where I had the chance to have an education. I'm a medical doctor. I'm a psychologist. I have two PhDs without being in debt. This is a huge privilege. And now,
especially that without being in debt part.
Yes.
I would like to emphasize that without being in debt.
Absolutely. So what a privilege, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, and now what would people, you know, suggest to me? They say, you know, you have two PhDs, you have to apply for a professorship here, or, you know, you would have a house and a car and a fence and a dog, you know, and an income and the salary. How come? Are you crazy? And then I say, you know, all these privileges, why should I eat them just for my own benefit? You know, I have all these privileges, and the majority of the human family, of my family, doesn't have these privileges. So how selfish it would be to simply, you know, eat them myself and say, oh, I'm entitled, I worked hard. Oh, no. You know, there's so many people who work very hard, much harder, you know. They are, you know, have terribly hard lives, and they get nothing for it. And, you know, so my duty is to invest my privileges, and there are many people who have privileges that they could invest. I see that, you know. Shall we really wait that the poor people in the Philippines save our lives?
Mm.
No, we who have privileges, who have resources, we have to invest them. So this is my kind of foundational motivation. You know, I feel, okay, the house is on fire. It's not the time for me to sit there and decorate my own life. You know, I need to be responsible for this house of ours, for our family.
So then, we've touched upon what inspired you to have this sense of responsibility.
Mm.
You know, this awareness of what has happened in your own life,
mm.
watching how the trauma of displacement and humiliation impacted your own parents,
mm-hmm.
And so, you know, being embedded in it in that sense, and then of course, you know, you've got this marvelous education that has trained you to think and so forth. Although I do want to acknowledge what you said about the difference between, you know, the sort of tactile learning versus being cooped up in a room with, you know, we were turned into this sort of automaton. You know, I mean, the bell rings.
Yes.
We respond to bells.
Oh,
isn't that amazing?
And the whole of Africa, you know, when people say, oh, we want to help Africa, we want to build schools, this is putting children into these kinds of prisons.
Sure, sure. As a matter of fact, on Facebook, there's a photograph that goes around every so often. And it's a photograph of two young boys. let's say they're in Kenya or Tanzania somewhere, you know, they're standing out in a grazing land, and you can see the cattle, you know, they're watching the cattle, and the caption above says, you know, in the United States, children have to spend 8 hours a day cooped up in a room with, you know, small windows, and they have to sit at this desk all day. And the other child, you know, sort of shaking his head, and, oh, that's just so terrible.
It's hugely terrible what we do, what we think we should do with each other.
So what is your understanding of where that comes from? Why are we doing that?
I think it is, if we think 12,000 years back, I have thought a lot about that and read for 10 years. There are lots of theories. But here comes my take. Planet Earth is limited in size. We started in Africa, and we somehow populated the planet, and we migrated, fragmented, settled, and fragmented. And, you know, one group, perhaps one brother, went to the next valley that was untouched and settled there. You still have that in for example, Uganda. Catherine told me that this was the way it was done. When there was some a newcomer, they would give him some land somewhere. They would have that land. But, you know, at some point in our history, the fact that our planet is infinite must have made itself more and more felt. You know, then you have the next valley taken by other people. This is what happens in Africa now, in Uganda now, you know. So, and what do you do when you are stuck? There is one word, circumscription. Circumscription means then you are that you are stuck. And what do you do? Okay, we as a human family, as humans, we have then developed agriculture. Like we have tried to get more resources out of where we were because we couldn't just go to the next valley and find more abundant food there. Okay, so agriculture is one smart idea, you could say. But with it come a lot of negative side effects that we couldn't know and we see just now. So there's one researcher who said agriculture was the biggest mistake we ever made as a human being, a human family. There are still taboos around. In Oregon, I met with indigenous people who still know about the taboo to hurt the land, to plant, to open the land and to plant. You know, so this going towards agriculture was not easy. I've written my doctoral thesis about genocide and humiliation and war in Somalia and in Rwanda. But in Somalia, I learned, okay, the proud, noble pastoralists, they look down on the agriculturalists. For them, this is to bow down is something humiliating. Okay, so we think that agriculture is a good idea. It fed more people, but you know, we have to think twice. The first agriculturalists had much worse health than the last gatherers and hunters. So it's perhaps not a good idea to develop domination. Like first we expanded horizontally, you could say. We populated our planet and then we learned how to expand vertically, to build dominating. We learned to dominate nature, animals, we domesticated animals, and we also dominated other people. Masters dominated underlings, slaves, you know. So we learned how to dominate and to extract more, you know. And this is what we maximized just now. And this will kill us. This will, you know, lead us into demise. So we have to rethink. What did we do there, like when the Neolithic Revolution started, when the first time we felt that our planet is finite? What did we do? We tried to squeeze it, dominate it. Okay, is that sustainable for a while, for the, you know, 12,000 years or some thousands of years? Yes, we could squeeze it, but now we see that we reach the limits. Now we see that other things are circumscribed: clean water, clean air, minerals. Okay, so we need to rethink our adaptation that we learned then and that has so deeply ingrained itself in our, we think it's natural and that it's our nature. But it's not. It's not. It's the last 5% of our history. And we have to rethink it. And we have to go back to what we did before and see, can we somehow regain, reclaim some of the connecting abilities that we have? Can we do something else in the face of limitation, then domination and squeezing and exploiting? Is there something else? Sharing, for example. What about sharing? What about defining ourselves as a human family on a finite planet, and that we have to learn to share? And, you know, we all know that rhetoric, you know. So this is, I think, we have to go back to where we started this domination culture, and we have to think through all its parts. You know, it comes up when you then get this question, yeah, but you need a job. You know, this is this culture, and it's so deeply ingrained that we don't have an alternative. Yeah, of course you need a job, you know. Of course, if you want to eat, you need a salary. Yeah.
Well, but then we have plenty of people who don't.
Yes, of course.
Right?
This is one thing, but, you know, there should, you know, poverty alleviation.
No, I'm not talking about the impoverished.
I know.
I'm talking about the other side of the strata. You know, those who have so much that they never have to work.
Yes, that's right. So,
and what values are around that. If you take just a moment to distill that, to think about that for just a moment, you know, that we have, you know, that those that are our heirs, you know, that their job is to be socialites. That perhaps, you know, well, I chair a charity or, you know, this, that, or the other, but that their families have amassed so much wealth that they don't get jobs. And we applaud them.
Absolutely.
However, we do have this other part of the way that our society has been stratified, which, you know, you went to first and alluded to, and it's those who don't have jobs and
right.
are poor, and we, you know, we excoriate them. We're horribly critical of them. They deserve whatever they get.
Right.
They're, you know, who are we?
Absolutely, absolutely. We think by forcing them into the system of the world system that Immanuel Wallerstein calls it world system, and that we live in now, which is defined, and I learned that from philosopher of social science Howard Richards, who has spent the past 40 years on thinking through that. He says, if we look at this world system of ours today, IMF, World Bank, all institutions that frame our life, they are successors of Roman law. And if we want to change these foundations, we have to think, in that case, 2,500 years back, and how it was enshrined in law, so that we believe that this is somehow these are our frames. We don't even see that there. So
ideas of vagrancy, loitering.
For example, if I don't have a contract, then I have no responsibility. So I don't have a contract with the rainforest in the Amazon, so I have no responsibility. Or I don't have a contract with the indigenous population there or there. So, you know, so there are many, many, many kind of cultural effects that come out of this Roman law. And he says, okay, there were other law systems, but now the world system is basically a successor of traditional Roman law. So we have, and he would say, you know, it's not the greed of some bankers, it's not the who are living in bubbles, which they do, isolated, where they don't see the world, they have no connection to the real world, which too. But the pillars of the system is what we have to change. And so it's Kathleen or Dora Hopper, she says, it's not enough with transformation, regulatory transformation. We need transformation by enlargement. We need to think much, 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 much bigger. We cannot stay within that system and simply regulate it. It doesn't work.
Mm. Mm. Profound.
Mm.
So then a way of approaching that that project, if you will, is, and I do want to bring us to at least touch upon how you're developing the philosophy the school sought, the conversation, if you will, around humiliation and dignity, and how it seems to me that that is a central kernel that informs everything else. So how is it that it boils down to humiliation
but
and humility? Yes.
What we have to learn is humility.
Yes.
And unlearn humiliation or undo mm-hmm. humiliation, heal humiliation, mm-hmm. prevent it. If you ask me about, this is Sangoma, if you ask me about my religion, I would say my religion is love, mm-hmm. humility, mm-hmm. and awe and wonderment in the face of the universe that is so much bigger than we can fathom.
Mm-hmm.
So humility is, I think, a core of what we have to learn as a human family. To me, there are two major things that we have to do differently in the future. We have to connect. This is what we already talked about a lot now, the social cohesion, the force of the collective to connect, but connect in a very new way. I remember I was working as a clinical psychologist for 7 years in Egypt, in Cairo. And there I had two groups of clients, the traditional Egyptians and then Westerners who worked there or who had married there. The Westerners, when they came with problems, the core problem was loneliness, the feeling that if I die, there will be nobody to cry.
Mm-hmm.
This was basically the mm-hmm. core problem. Egyptians would never have that problem because they would always be embedded in big, large extended families and they would know their place. They would, no doubt, But they had problems with oppressive collectives, the oppressive side in a collective where they could not get out. So what we have done in the West, we have somehow liberated ourselves from the oppressive aspect, but we have thrown out the baby with the bathwater. We have thrown out the connection also. So we have to reclaim the connection, the social glue, but without the oppression. So two things we need to connect, and we need to connect by respecting each other's equality in dignity. So it's not dignity, it's equality in dignity, or respect for equality in dignity for all, which is the turning point. And this is somehow undoing what we did when we started with agriculture, with our domination culture. Then we created cultures of unequal dignity. There were people born high and people born low, and we still have it in India. People believe in other parts of the world that they aren't born low, and there's a reason for that. And so this is the past 5% of our history. Many parts of the world were characterized by unequal dignity. And everybody would believe that this is nature's law, God's or divine will. So what we have to do now is two things: connect and connect in equality and dignity. I use the motto of unity in diversity. We need to unite and respect so that diversity can flourish.
Now then, I would like to trouble that for a moment because I see a potential for a sort of contradiction. Ironically, if one put it this way, freedom can be oppressive, depending on whose freedom we are asserting. So what if, for example, I want to be part of a polygamous marriage,
right,
and that for some people, for a lot of people, the idea of that is just absolutely horrible.
Right.
When
we have many examples. Like, what if I'm a pedophile and think that my freedom should be to be a pedophile?
I make a distinction there.
Okay.
I make a distinction there. Some people may think that it's a distinction without a difference, but I really do believe that it is a difference. When we're talking about a polygamous marriage, I also anticipate mm-hmm. it being amongst consenting adults.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, of course, the issue of, well, what about underage people and
right.
and arranged or forced marriages and so forth. Pedophilia, the children are not consenting.
Right.
What about in a situation where we are consenting adults and we want to have a polygamous marriage?
Everything for me that is embedded in this responsibility for nurturing human relationships that are not oppressive, that are giving the space to every individual to nurture his or her own potential in a certain space. Like you would exclude pedophilia, for example. You would draw a line within that line. You know, I listened carefully to Catherine Odora Hoppers and her brother who came then from Uganda, and how they described the life, you know, that was there at their homestead. Her father had many wives, and all the children lived with their wives. Every wife had a hut, as you know. And, you know, I think this is not the big difference. What kind of marriage? That there, the fault line between, let's say now, constructive and destructive doesn't run there. It runs elsewhere. It runs where I respect other people as human beings that have equal dignity and that I nurture. And so there runs the fault line. If I force people and my children into something, then it becomes a straitjacket. So I would, you know, as I said, I was extremely happy as a child in a big extended collective. And then when I was together with my nuclear family, I got hugely unhappy, you know. So, yeah.
Yes. Right, yeah, yeah. Wouldn't it be great then if we were able to at some point then, you know, make that choice, I suppose, and it's something to think about, I guess. You know, what's going on in my mind here as I'm speaking and then also thinking is whether there might be some system that's available that at some age of maturity a person can make that sort of choice. And say, I prefer to live in a collective, say, I prefer
just
to
recently,
live...
Just recently, I met a couple, gay couple. They had children with a lesbian couple. It had a family with many children, with different fathers, different mothers. It was wonderful.
So it can be, right. So there's more to talk about as far as that's concerned. It's a very fascinating area. As I was preparing for our conversation, you know, I watched snippets of other videos that you've made, and this was a question that I did want to bring up, is that tension, I think, that arises when the idea of equality comes up, and then we now need to start looking at culture and how culture impacts the idea of equality.
Yep.
I was wondering whether you have had opportunity to consider perhaps the distinction between thinking in terms of equality, which I think presumes rights in a sense, and the thought of how that might be distinct from an idea of being needs focused.
Right. I think there is, you know, this first sentence of the first article of the Human Rights Convention says every human being is born free and equal in dignity and rights. And I think that the entitlement approach to rights, the fact also that we call it human rights, I tend to call it human rights ideals.
Mm.
And to me, dignity is the carrier there. And we as a human family in 1948, we started to focus on political rights because it's easier to tackle, and the lawyers, they go there and they define it, and you know. But dignity, yeah, is what counts, and laws can undermine dignity. So this is not an unproblematic relationship between human rights and human dignity. Human rights can undermine human dignity, and dignity must come first, and equality in dignity. It's not dignity, because dignity in the past, as I said, we have the past 5% of our human history is hierarchical, dominator societies. Rihanna Eisler would call them the dominator model of society, and there also dignity was a term that signified that some people are higher, dignitarians are higher. So the term dignity also was part of this ranking system. And so what is the point today is respect for equal dignity for all, not dignity. And, you know, this is the big turning point, like this sentence, every human being.
Mm-hmm. But so then what does dignity mean?
You know, dignity is something that is hotly discussed among philosophers and others, and nobody, I think it's dignifying not to look for a definition, and to look at people, and this is my experience globally, the notion of dignity is in the bodies of people. And how do I see this? It's a kind of getting your head up, you know, rising, saying, I'm somebody, perhaps. Like I felt, you know, I have no right to be on this planet. So I'm trying, you know, all these displaced people or people who are, like I did, as I said, I did my research in Rwanda. Many people said, just look at the body language of Hutus. Hutu means servant. They will go down with the head, you know. And if you look at somebody who stands straight, you can guess he has a Tsi background from the four elite. So it's in our bodies. And the past 5 years, ranked culture has made some of us bow or shrink in our bodies, while others, the bosses, the masters, stood high and straight. And equality in dignity means that we that we gather at the same line of equality in dignity. I usually say, okay, if I respect myself so much and I respect you equally much, then we are on one line of equality in dignity. And this is the big historical paradigm shift we are part of, that people who formerly were down, they rise. And this is the core of this change, the core of this transition. And as I said, at the moment, we are not taking care enough. That it's not enough to just rise. We also have to hold hands.
Great.
Yeah. It's not enough to be everybody rising and say, this is my right, my human right, this and that, you know. And if the rainforest is destroyed, this doesn't, you know, I have my right to have a Ferrari here, you know, So what we forget is to hold hands. So we have two transitions, and we need to nurture these two transitions more intentionally. We have the first from unequal dignity to equal dignity, and the other is from isolation to holding hands, and not in oppressive ways, but in the context of equality and dignity. And so these are the two challenges we as a human family have now, two challenges. And this is what I try to kind of work for in my entire life, you know, to bring people together as a global family. And then to see, can we live together as a family? And what is it a family does? There is an anthropologist, Alan Page Fiske. He defined four ways of how people can collaborate. He says there's communal sharing. This is what families do. You know, I give according to ability and I take according to need. Then there's authority ranking. You can have the master, the cruel master, but you can also have the good parent. Then you have equality matching. I take care of your baby if you take my cat. Then we have market pricing. And what we have emphasized is market pricing, which is the most impoverished form of collaboration. And we sell out our grandmother for that. You know, we sell out what makes us human, because we prioritize market pricing, the fourth way of collaboration. We give it priority to define our the institutions, the structures, even our cultures, even. So we have to undo that and to put communal sharing, the ways good families are collaborating. We have to see whether we can manifest that globally.
I want to make a note. First of all, thank you so, so very much for that explanation. I understand it much better. I mean, I know that, you know, I tossed a hard ball out there, if I can use the baseball analogy, which not everybody gets. I'm becoming more sensitive, I think, to using very culturally specific, examples. But what is the matter is that I think you've done a marvelous job in a short period of time of explaining this very complex and rich concept, you know, in the way that you are and those who are working with you are envisioning it. I do want to say to those who are listening live that the show may go quiet for you in about 30 seconds, which is it's fine because we're going to continue recording. We'll continue the conversation for a few more minutes. And then if you miss out on the conversation, once the show is available on demand, you can come back and listen to the part of the conversation that you missed. So the recorded version of the show is going to have the entirety of our conversation. So I want an opportunity for folks to know then, you know, as you talked about thinking through these concepts, it's not something that you're doing alone. You've mentioned a number of scholars who are involved in some way in the project of developing these thoughts. And so then there is this workshop, and I'd love for you to present to us what one can expect to experience by coming to this workshop on the 5th and the 6th.
We start at 9 o'clock with registration, and everybody who wants to participate in the workshop, please write in so that you can be, that we know you. And it's upon invitation, so we invite people who write to us and explain who they are, and then we invite everybody. So, except, you know, if it's really full. We had one that was 100 people, and we felt it was too much. So we need to, at some point, be careful. Yes, so we start on the 5th, it's Thursday at 9 o'clock with registration, and the workshop starts at 10. And our main aim is to nurture this cohesion in equality and dignity. People come to conferences with the expectation, why do they come? You know, they need to read a paper, they need it for their CV, or it's to show, to have airs, you know, a stage to bring your ideas. So we discourage helicopter participation, but we encourage people to be there and to really build this family. The most important part of the workshop starts afterwards. You know, we want to, sometimes I say we want to identify all the Mandelas in the world and invite into that family. So this is your job then in this workshop, to look around, to be a Mandela, to link up with other Mandelas, to build connections. Not this is a workshop and tomorrow it's finished and then I go. You know, is that enough to the global family? No.
Not at all.
We are not observers who can simply go, you know. So the workshop, it's an opportunity for Mandelas to be together and to link up, and to nurture each other, and to build this force as a collective. Under the heading of dignity, equality in dignity, and holding hands. This is the kind of larger heading. It's not a sect. It's not anything. It's not a cult. It's just be a family. Mm-hmm. How can we be a family on this planet? That's all.
Well, I am certainly looking forward to it myself. I'm going to be there very enthusiastically.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And again, I encourage folks who are listening, who are interested, to contact you. It is something that requires pre-registration, as
mm-hmm.
you have mentioned.
Yes, you just go on the website, and there you can see the email address.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And, of course, the information that folks need to provide is going to
there
be...
There is a public event on the afternoon of this Thursday, which is free without registration.
Okay.
It starts at 5 in Milbank Chapel.
Okay.
So there everybody can come and just without registration.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm. And yes, to make sure that folks know where it is, at Teachers College,
right.
At Columbia University.
That's right.
We'll take the one train,
that's
if
right.
you're here in New York City, take the one train to 116th
yes.
Street and then walk north
yes.
on Broadway
that's
until
right.
you get to 122nd.
I think it's
121st. Huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Right.
You
mm-hmm.
go to Teachers College.
Right.
If you can't find it, ask somebody.
Right.
Or use your iPhone or,
right.
You know, GPS.
And then,
or,
you know, we have the program of the workshop. You need to register. You know, you don't get into Teachers College with
yes.
If you don't have an ID card.
Yeah.
So we will put the program there. So then the security people at the entrance will know about our workshop.
Okay. So the main thing, though, is it requires pre-registration, right. So please be sure to pre-register.
Right. Exactly.
Oh, Evelyn, I'm so glad we had this chance to have this conversation. I've been looking forward to it. I really have. The last time we met, it was Occupy
December.
Wall Street. Was going on.
Mm.
Yes, or it was right after Occupy Wall
That's
Street.
Right.
Yes, because Occupy Wall Street was shut down on November 17th.
That's right.
If I remember correctly. So you would have been here already.
You're right.
And we had a chance to hang out a bit with
right.
my marvelous co-mediator, Tashi Enders, who
mm-hmm.
is from West Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Or, well, from Germany now,
mm-hmm.
but, you know,
mm-hmm.
She's from Berlin. And so we had a chance to hang
mm-hmm.
out, and it was
mm-hmm.
a ton of fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I've been looking forward to having this conversation and delving a little bit more deeply into the work that you're doing, which I truly admire and receive with great joy.
I admire you and your dedication and vision and your energy. You know, this is what, you know, I'm leaving the planet earlier than you. You will be there. You will be around longer. And you give me hope and strength and joy just looking at you.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Mm.
And don't count yourself out.
No. I will turn 60 next year, and this will be the start of my life. I have defined the first 60 years as apprenticeship, and when
fabulous.
I turn 60 next year, then
this is it. This is life now.
Then life will start, and I will work until or live this life until I will be 120, and
yes.
I will use 1 week for dying.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds like a plan. Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you so very much for taking time to chat with me. I'd love to have you back again at some point. And I thank
my
you.
Honor.
Oh, absolutely. I thank you all, folks, for tuning in and listening. I invite you to come back again each week or so. The show will not be airing next week. It's going to be Thanksgiving. So we are taking a break for that. When we return, we will have another guest to share with you. So I do invite you to come back. Also, when you come to the show's website, you will see there a link that allows you to subscribe to the show. This means that you will never miss a show. You will get updates of when our next show is going to air. And it allows me to know that you are there and you are listening, and I really appreciate that. So have a wonderful week, everybody, and we'll see you again next time.